Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name's Craig Forces. I'm here at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs, high above the Rideau River in Stephanie Carvin's office once again. Stephanie,
avast.
That's all our frivolity for the today.
That's and possibly the year, because we're possibly not really for good the at year. That.
And yeah. Why are we doing that, Stephanie?
Well, because yesterday was International Pirates Day, and I guess we should have maybe done this last week. But we're going to talk a little bit about pirates.
Yeah, so we missed it by a day, but there's no point in having an international talk like a pirate day if you can't bend the rules.
Right, exactly. We're gonna mess that up.
So what are we going to do today?
So we are going to talk about piracy, just briefly, because it is interesting. And then we're going to talk about also, you know, since it's Talk Like a Pirate Day, what happens when it's Talk Like a Terrorist Day?
Right.
I would advise not talking like a terrorist generally, but we're going to look at the speech crime issue in C-59 and kind of try to unpack it a bit, because this is something that I think is going to come up again in the C-59 debate as it makes its way through the Senate.
Right. And so this is our first in a series of sessions where we're going to try to walk through the aspects of C-59. And as advertised, in our prior season, last season, we walked through them in order of the act. This time what we're going to do is we're going to tell some stories. So we're going to come up with minor hypothetical storylines and talk about how the rules apply to those storylines, both the existing rules, the rules in C-51 where they apply, and also the rules in C-59 where it enacted, just to give a sense as to how this works in practice rather than sort of in this obscure, esoteric legal context.
Right. I like to think of it as super nerdy, choose your own adventure.
Right. Call of Duty, but boring.
Yes.
All right. So let's talk about our Hostess Humani issues, our piracy issues.
So excited. Okay, yeah. So Adventures on the High Seas. So a couple of things here that I think are interesting we can say right off the bat is that piracy, it's one of the earliest examples that we have of the idea of individual criminal responsibility. Right. And it's funny we see that now. Like, we have an international criminal court now, which John Bolton trashed. Maybe we want to talk about that at some point, but, you know, that's the thing. And what's really interesting about piracy is that way back in, we're talking the 17th, 18th century, the idea of pirates were basically, these were criminals. As you say, Hostess Humani.
Enemies of humankind.
Enemies of humankind. So, like, literally what's interesting about them is, like, for hundreds of years, the idea that you can arrest a pirate, that you can, any state can arrest a pirate anywhere, so on the high seas, and prosecute them pretty much anywhere, and that's fine. And there's very few other areas of international law where those kinds of law exist. I think back in the day, back in, you know, the 17th century, when you had, like, the great writers, philosophers that were writing about this, like, you know, they talked about cannibals. You could do this with cannibals,
right.
But I don't actually recall any
cases. And by the 19th century, slave trade.
Right.
Right. So, yes. So the idea of, you're right, this is one of these classic examples, accepted, I think, without question, of what's known as universal jurisdiction in international law. And
yes.
So any state can proscribe it. That is, outlaw acts of piracy on the high seas. Now, we're going to have to define what we mean by piracy, because that's actually also a contested issue.
Yes, it is.
But you're right. Since then, the list has grown. And so war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, these are also what's known as universal jurisdiction crimes, although there's a debate as to whether that stems from what's known as custom international law or is a creature of treaty. But the bottom line is that piracy is a customary crime that's existed that attaches individual culpability in international law to individuals, which is very rare, because most of international law is about assigning responsibility to states in terms of policing their conduct.
And the idea that, like, a person has a responsibility in international law is kind of
relatively novel.
Yeah, relatively novel, but this is the one example we have of it kind of dating back. So
why do we care about piracy still? I mean, so we're talking, you know, it's not the Black Pearl here that's still sailing the Caribbean.
It's kind of disappointing. Really, because, you know, I have to say, though, maybe we could talk about our favorite pirate films. Mine is Captain Blood from 1936. Really, really good. Errol Flynn at his finest.
Well, I like Mutiny on the Bounty, but for reasons we'll discuss in a moment, that's technically not piracy.
Oh, right. Okay. So we're talking about, you know, piracy has been, there was kind of like a revamp of it in a comeback in around, like, the late 2000s. So between really 2008 to 2010, we saw a large uptick in the amount of piracy, particularly off the coast of Somalia. But that's not the only area of the
world. Malacca Straits.
Right. And in the Philippines and stuff like this. And so there has been, you know, there was famous cases in 2008, a French court charged six Somalis with piracy following the release of hostages that had been taken on a French yacht. And they were actually apprehended by French forces. And the Somali government actually gave its blessing to the French government to actually prosecute them. So this is a case of actually, I don't think they needed to. Because if it was piracy, you wouldn't need the permission, I think, of the Somali government, but they gave it anyways. There's the famous case. There was the, you know, the I Am the Captain Now movie, Captain Phillips.
Captain Phillips with
Captain
Tom
Phillips.
Hanks.
Yeah. Right, yeah. So that was the Maersk, Alabama case in 2009, which they sent in basically U.S. ships to rescue a ship that had been taken hostage. As well, in 2010, there were two cases of Somali pirates who were arrested. They had fired on American naval ships, which seems like a bad idea, a bad life choice. If you're a pirate, that's not something I personally would do. But anyway, so they arrested 11 Somali pirates and brought them to the United States, where they've been charged and convicted of piracy. So it's and what's happened now, what's kind of interesting is we've seen a large decrease, because I think states saw this increase of piracy in the Somalia in particular. And what they've done is they put ships out there to try and stop this piracy from happening. They were pretty successful. And today, pirate attacks have actually fallen to their lowest levels in nearly two decades. However, the places where we're seeing an increase is it's more than doubled again in the Philippines. So that's unfortunate. So piracy remains a very important issue. But it's also one of these crazy issues where the people who actually tend to benefit the most from piracy are insurance companies. Right. Because, you know, all these ships now are taking out piracy insurance, and insurance companies are making millions of dollars off of this. One or two ships might be caught, but chances are you've made so much money off of the insurance that you're selling. That's actually a pretty good business. So if you need strangely enough, it's created this very lucrative insurance business on the side.
Huh. Well, and I think piracy also, it raises interesting legal issues. So basically, I want to talk about two aspects on the legal side. We mentioned the universal jurisdiction idea, that if you can lay hands on one of these pirates, you can prosecute them, assuming your domestic law has actually anticipated that eventuality. You're permitted to do that anywhere because it's universal jurisdiction. But the starting point for piracy is really the UN Clause, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which specifies that illegal acts of violence committed for private ends, and I'll come back to that in a second, by crew or passengers of a private ship or aircraft on the high seas against another ship or aircraft on the high seas, that's piracy. That's simplifying the definition a little bit. And there's a couple of definitions done for private ends. And there's actually a debate about this. And so if you do it for monetary gain, that's piracy. If you do it for political objectives, well, there's a debate as to whether that constitutes piracy or not. Also, if you take a ship upon which you're a passenger hostage, that's not piracy because it doesn't involve two ships.
Right.
You have to have two ships. There's also this issue on the high seas. So that's outside the territorial waters of states. Now, any state ship encountering a pirate on the high seas is entitled under the UN Clause to seize that ship, which then is the basis for subsequent prosecutions. What's interesting about those prosecutions, by the way, in terms of this universal jurisdiction offense is, so there is an arrangement, my understanding, for Somali pirates. Many of them are prosecuted in Kenya, even though they're caught by non-Kenyan vessels.
Right.
One of the issues is if let's say you're a Canadian frigate and you capture a pirate off the coast of Somalia and you transfer him to custody within Canada, and there is a prosecution, which in principle I assume is available under the Criminal Code Section 77 and forward, which deals with offenses against air and maritime safety, and I believe that's extraterritorial. If you do that, you prosecute the person, you're successful, they go in jail. Once they come out of jail, can you remove them back to Somalia, right? So there's this issue about whether they'd be ever amenable to a removal back to what has been, up until comparatively recently, essentially a failed state.
Right.
And so the concern has been, yeah, you can prosecute them, but what's your
end
game?
And you're stuck with them, right?
Well, possibly, right? So just to segue into our conversation about terrorism, in the 1980s, especially in 85, we saw this very famous incident, the Achille Lauro incident, which involved the seizure of a cruise ship by Palestinian PLO terrorists.
Yes.
Involving ultimately hostage-taking, demanding the freeing of Palestinian prisoners. One passenger ends up dying.
The Klinghoffer. It was Kling. Didn't they make an opera about this? John Adams made an opera, The Death of Klinghoffer.
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's great. It's a good
really?
Opera. Yeah.
Okay.
it's a modern opera. It's brilliant. And it's actually, you know, it's brilliant because it actually presents the Palestinians as a, you know, it makes them human,
right,
at least, you know, even though they're killing a guy.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but the bottom line is that it was very unclear whether this could be considered piracy, because they seized a ship while passengers of the ship for political ends. And so in the aftermath of that, there was a new international convention negotiated to deal with this very circumstance. It's called the Convention for the Suppression of Unlawful Acts Against the Safety of Maritime Navigation from 1988. And there have been a series of other specialized, and they're called anti-terrorism conventions, dealing with fixed platforms, so oil rigs, and also aviation security. And so that's actually where a lot of the international criminal law for these other sort of collateral acts that aren't technically piracy, that's where it really exists at present in these separate UN conventions.
Right. So I think, you know, one of the other things here, just to mention, though, is like there used to be something called privateering. But nowadays, in the modern sense, there's no distinction anymore, right?
Mr. Barrett's Privateer?
No, it's a great song, right? Yeah. Actually, okay, so to research this, I was like, how many Canadian pirates were there? And it's you know, there's different estimates out there, but there was a lot of piracy going on in the East Coast. Well, maybe
but,
I should...
But privateers weren't technically pirates.
So this is just it, right? Because they had a letter of marque, right? So
they were state actors.
They were state actors, or... Ish.
Right, ish. They're pirate-ishy.
Pirate-ishy. But they got banned because during the Crimean War, all states agreed not to use privateers, and they didn't. And then they decided in the aftermath of it, the Declaration of Paris in 1856, all the states came around and basically said they're not going to use privateers anymore. So privateers became banned in international law, except one state decided not to sign on to that. Do you know who that state was?
United States.
It was. Yeah. And why?
Because they didn't have a standing navy of any size.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so, however, they agreed to abide by the rules. It's one of these things where the United States doesn't want to sign on to the law, but tends to abide by the rules.
Yeah, it's probably customary by now, too.
Right. So, and all the other conventions that we have. So they abided by the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, and they... And now they have, like, you know, a pretty good navy. I don't think they need privateers anymore. So, but it is interesting to distinguish and how this one little letter of marque can suddenly make you a legitimate actor, which actually happens in Captain Blood.
Right.
Right? He takes on I forget, it's like the perfidious French or the perfidious Spanish or the perfidious French and Spanish at some point. It's great. Great film. So good. Everyone should see it. Okay.
Right. Well, and my film, yeah. My film wouldn't work either way. Not piracy, because it involves my film, Mutiny on the Bounty. So for those of you who don't know, the infamous British Captain Bligh, who in the movie rendition at least is a brutal captain in the British Navy, and is ultimately provokes a mutiny by Lieutenant Christian, and ultimately takes over the ship. Captain Bligh, by the way, the side story to this. He's set adrift with the loyal members of the crew and manages to navigate across the better part of the Pacific and arrive safely. He was a fantastic navigator. Christian and his fellows took the bounty to the Pitcairn Islands. And actually, my understanding is the descendants of the residents of the Pitcairn Islands are the descendants of Christian and those members of the South Pacific indigenous communities that they picked up along the way. So the bottom line, though, is that's not piracy because it involved one ship, nor, incidentally, would it be captured by this suppression of unlawful acts against the safety of maritime navigation if it were to have applied. Why? Because that convention doesn't apply to a state ship.
Right. But I have seen cases, particularly involving Canadian pirates, where they overthrow people on the ship, and then they called that piracy. Those were used as fishing vessels. But you know how they punished the guy? They basically dumped tar on him and then hung him. And I'm thinking that's a little dramatic. But
Hold on a sec. So I think probably you mean to use the actual, speaking like a pirate, feed the fish with them or blow the man down.
Blow the man down. Okay. Heave ho.
All right.
So this has been my favorite episode so far. It's so much fun.
That click you hear is everyone turning off their podcast players.
We really should have just made hats for this episode. Right.
Which works well for this kind of podcast.
Right.
All right. So let's move on to more serious matters.
Right.
So Bill C-59, still in Parliament, went through the Commons, now in the Senate. First reading on the Senate was before...
I should have made it a birthday cake.
Yeah, that's true, actually. It's past his birthday, which was June. And so Senate first reading was prior to the summer recess. It's going to debate on second reading next week,
right?
After which, who knows how long that debate will be, but it'll go to committee. So what we've decided to do is we're going to walk through some of the aspects of C-59 again, and we're going to start, in part because of Colin Freese in The Globe, he had a story which is pertinent, which we'll come to in a second this week. We're going to start with what I call the speech crime, otherwise known as the advocacy or promotion of terrorism offenses in general crime, which is found after C51 in section 83.221 of the criminal code.
For the audience, I'm just going to note that Craig just said that off the top of his head. It is impressive. It never fails to impress me. Right.
All
right.
So what we thought we'd do, though, rather than sort of talking about this esoteric legal language, is we'd walk through a series of what I'll call speech acts, just to explain where rules of criminal law apply to certain sorts of speech. Some of the speech is going to be off color, right? It's meant to be offensive speech. But at what point does the speech become so offensive that it's criminalized? And I think
you've actually written a script here.
I've written
a bit
of a script here.
Yeah.
So just to be clear here, I mean, we talk often about free speech rights and their free expression rights in the charter context, and they're very important. And of course, they're coming up again and again in the wake of this Toronto Council debacle. But the issue really is that our free expression rights are not absolute. And there are many circumstances where speech can cross a red line and provoke a criminalization and culpability. So where that line is matters. And then there's some policy issues we can talk about as well. But bottom line, we're going to walk through a series of speech acts. And so the first one I have,
do you want me to narrate?
Sure,
okay,
sure.
I'll be the narrator. So I'll be speaker one, quote, "I want Frank to be mayor of Toronto because he'll support real Canadians."
Right. Okay. So
I feel bad I'm subjecting the audience to my acting. But
anything wrong with that? No, right? That's just a conventional expression of political opinion.
It has some kind of maybe negative connotations, real Canadians as opposed to fake Canadians, it's fine.
But again, the point being that not speech that offends is not criminalized.
Right.
All right. So speaker number two. Okay. Which is even more dramatic. And by the way, this is in fact from a blog of a notorious figure who has in the past participated in Toronto elections. It's somewhat edited, but this is not entirely an invention.
Okay, please, no one edit this together and send this to my tenure committee.
So, important, this is not Stephanie's views.
It is not.
This is
Stephanie's bad acting.
This is a simulation.
Yes, okay. So we're endorsing Frank for mayor. Frank is a real Canadian despite his time in jail. He cares about poor people and the dangerous situation in Toronto's housing situation. And he's right about Toronto's gun violence. It's not a gun problem. It's a black community problem.
Right.
I don't believe that.
So to be clear, that is not an invented statement. That is an edited version of a statement made by a person who's involved in municipal politics in Toronto. Okay. So is that offensive?
Yes.
Is it unlawful?
It's incorrect, it's probably demonstrably false, but it's not.
The bottom line is that's not unlawful.
It's not unlawful. Right? I can't see anything there
so,
that's not unlawful.
So again, free speech includes offensive speech. That's the nature of free speech. The outer limit here that might potentially apply, but frankly, given the language here, would not be sufficiently excessive, is what's known as hate speech. And so, for example, in section 319 sub 2 of the criminal code, willful promotion of hate. Everyone who communicates statements other than in private conversation who willfully promotes hatred against any identifiable group. All right. So that's the offense which it comes closest to applying. The problem is, of course, is that does trench on free expression and has been upheld by the Supreme Court in a case called Keekstra,
right,
which was a Holocaust denial case.
Yeah.
Very, very close case, by the way. It was upheld as being a violation of free speech, yes, but it survived under what's known as a Section 1 analysis as reasonable in a free and a democratic society. The reason it survived, amongst others, was that it confined to very extreme speech. And so the Supreme Court, in a more recent case called Waticott, said that it does not reach speech causing emotional distress to individual group members. It has to be more than speech that ridicules, belittles, or offends the dignity of group members. It must expose the person to detestation and vilification.
And that it doesn't really reach that level.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, I can find it very offensive, which I think it is, but it's not. There's a threshold there.
Right. So there's going to be debate about this. And frankly, in popular discourse, sometimes I think people set the bar too low because in practice, what we're looking for in terms of the prosecutions that have existed are so-called hallmarks of hate, which the Supreme Court has also talked about. So blaming a group's members for the current problems in society, alleging they are a powerful menace, asserting that they're parts of secret conspiracies, plotting to destroy Western civilization, labeling them liars, cheats, criminals, thugs, pedophiles, child abusers, dehumanizing members of the group by describing its members as animals or subhuman. Those are all indicia or indicators or hallmarks of hate that would probably cause a statement to fall closer to the range of what's known as hate speech.
Okay.
So what about number three then?
Okay. So the statement says, "The people who come from Lower Slobovia are parasites who need to be castrated."
Right.
Take that, Slobovia.
Okay. So there, I think you come much closer to those indicators or hallmarks of hate. So this is probably willful promotion of hate. Now, under the criminal code, that's subject to a few defenses.
Right.
One defense is truth.
Right.
One defense is in good faith, expressing or attempting to establish an argument or an opinion on a religious subject. Okay, so that's another defense. A statement made in public interest, a discussion of which was for the public benefit, or in good faith, intending to point out for the purpose of removal matters producing or tending to produce feelings of hatred, right?
So okay, so all of this, from what I can see, all of this so far is we're in the realm of hate crime. Mm-hmm. We're not in the realm of terrorism.
Nope.
We're not in the realm of violent extremism.
Right, we're walking up a ladder here.
Walking up a ladder. And so like a lot of the stuff we're talking about is some of the issues that have affected campuses recently in Ontario, but not necessarily hit the terrorism threshold.
Right.
Right.
So then we get up to a different sort of speech. Speaker number four.
Speaker number four. I am going to attack people from Lower Slobovia.
Right. So is that free expression? It's not hate speech. It could be.
Wouldn't context matter here?
Context matters. And so there's probably other things that might embellish that so that it is hate speech.
Right.
But alone, it's probably not hate speech.
Yeah.
Is it criminal? So first of all, is that an example of free expression under the Charter? Well, free expression does not protect threats or acts of violence.
Right.
That is a built-in constraint on what we mean by free speech.
Right.
It doesn't even have to go to a Section 1 analysis. It just is not free speech. All right. So there are many examples of what we can call speech crimes in the criminal code that are tied to violence. And so, for example, uttering threats to kill or cause bodily harm to someone or to damage property is a criminal code offense. And so arguably, our speaker here, in speaker number four, I am going to attack people from Lower Slobovia, has uttered threats.
Right. So, again, though, but if I said to you on this podcast, I'm going to attack Kenya, the ridiculousness of that is, like, there's context there, but presumably the courts would have to take that in consideration?
Well, so you would have to find it. So I'm going to attack Kenya as probably not protected speech under Section 2, but to criminalize that, you'd have to find an offense that was that generic, right? As opposed to uttering threats that are directed at persons, uttering threats that are directed at a state, a nation state, and it wouldn't fit. At least uttering threats wouldn't fit. And so the issue is going up our ladder. Are there other things that might fit that sort of scenario?
Okay.
And so let's talk about speaker number five.
Right. It is your sworn duty, fellow Canadians, to wreak vengeance on the people of Lower Slobovia. Take up the weapons available to you.
Right.
That seems to be inciting.
Inciting, right?
Right.
And so incitement is the generic term we use.
Right.
So the offense here would actually be counseling. So in a counseling offense, so you're counseling people to engage in an offense. It could be any number of offenses that we're talking about here. And so counseling a person to engage in a criminal offense, if you counsel a person, then you're actually a party to the offense. And offense need not actually ever arise, but you're a party to that potential offense. And you can, in fact, be prosecuted and put in jail. And so in use the term incitement. So counseling is procuring, soliciting, or inciting a crime. And the Supreme Court requires that you really have to have the intent. You have to intend that the offense counsel be committed or knowingly counsel the commission of the offense while aware of the unjustified risk that the offense counseled was in fact likely to be committed.
Okay.
All right.
So we've talked about counseling before, but we'll presume we're coming back to this, the difference between.
Yes, we will. We'll come back to the issue of counseling and when the difference of some of these other offenses in a second.
Right. Okay. So do you want me to do number six?
Sure.
Give money to our brothers in the Upper Slobovia Assembly of Patriots.
Right. And so let's assume that.
So I'm guessing the assembly here is a legislative bot. Or is it
an assembly? Let's assume it's a non-government entity, one of which purposes is terrorist activity.
Okay, so it's a violent extremist group.
It's a violent extremism
group. Okay, great.
Right.
So give money. So basically you're counseling facilitation?
Counseling facilitation or even more straightforward, counseling terrorist financing.
Right.
We're now into our terrorism offenses. So you're counseling, in this case, a terrorism offense, and there's a number of terrorist financing offenses. This would be one of them. It would certainly reach financing of a terrorist group.
Okay.
And a terrorist group, recall from some of our prior discussions, can include an entity, one of whose purposes is to engage in terrorist activity. And we've stipulated that's true on these facts.
Right.
All right. So, again, you can go to jail for that.
Right. For telling people to send money to a terrorist group.
Right.
Okay. Don't do that, podcast listeners. Speaker 7. I have come from Canada and joined the Upper Slobovia Assembly of Patriots. We, the members of the Upper Slobovia... Really, could you have not picked something that just flows a little better? Okay. We, the members of the Upper Slobovia Assembly of Patriots, call on those who are not able to join us to take up arms in Canada against the evil Lower Slobovians where they may be found.
All right, so what does that sound like?
It sounds like incitement again, or encouraging, counseling people to join a terrorist group.
Yeah, or engage in terrorist activity. And in fact, this is not too dissimilar from some of those infamous videos that we saw coming out of Canadians who had joined ISIS in the last few years.
Like John McGuire.
John McGuire's video, exactly, right? Yeah. So, and how many different ways would this person be potentially criminally culpable, right? So counseling an offense, yes. There's also a specialized terrorism offense known as participation in a terrorist group. Right. We've talked about this in the past.
Yes.
So more
it's
than
not a, just showing up, but now he's actually
he's doing something for them. Right. He's doing something to enhance the capacity of the terrorist group to engage in terrorist activity. And so that's and it's more than de minimis. Right.
It's more than a post on social media saying, hey, look at me.
Yeah.
I'm
it's very active.
Yeah.
Could you go to jail? Not because of what you said, per se, but because you're saying it for this purpose to enhance the capacity of the terrorist group to do what it is the terrorist groups do. Absolutely. So this would be a participation offense.
So that's interesting because that makes John McGuire like if he had lived, he's super dead. Yeah. But like if he had come back, we could have prosecuted
him.
Unlike other returnees who've come back where they haven't done these kinds of things.
He's a self-incriminating individual, right? Because he made these statements.
Right.
So
unless he could prove it was under duress or something.
Possibly. So there might be defenses. But the bottom line is participation in a terrorist group. Here, the participation happens to be a speech act. It's not limited to a speech act. It just happens to be a speech act. But the speech act itself can amount to participation, which means that a speech act could be criminalized for purposes of participation in a terrorist group. And we have one individual in prison, Mr. Namu, who was prosecuted for, amongst other things, being a propagandist for terrorist groups.
That's right. He actually made propaganda. He did something for a terrorist group.
Which is all speech.
Right.
But it fell within the ambit of these sorts of participation crimes.
I think he'd also gotten into some facilitation.
He did a whole bunch of other stuff, too.
Wasn't good. But this was one of the charges.
Yeah. The other thing that our speaker number 7 could be guilty of is what's known as instruction of terrorist activity. And so that's found in 82.22 of the Criminal Code. Let me just give you a sense of what it says. The person's guilty who knowingly instructs, directly or indirectly, any person to carry out a terrorist activity, whether or not the terrorist activity is actually carried out, whether or not the accused instructs a particular person to carry out the terrorist activity, whether or not the accused knows the identity of the person whom the accused instructs to carry out the terrorist activity, and whether or not the person whom the accused instructs to carry out the terrorist activity knows that it's a terrorist activity. Right. And so this is meant to capture basically a cell structure where you bounce your instructions through a cell structure. But the bottom line is this is a very broad offense that captures all sorts of statements. I think at least arguably speaker number 7 falls within instructing terrorist activity. So at least three ways over speaker number 7 can go to jail.
Okay. He's not doing himself any favors.
Nope.
Okay.
All right. So now we get to the interesting stuff.
Right. Speaker number 8. An op-ed in the Upper Slobovia Community Weekly in Toronto says, "Hooray, our brave fighters in the Upper Slobovia Assembly of Patriots."
So is that a crime?
See, this is what's interesting, because this is where we find a lot of radicalizers in Canada who won't say you should join the Islamic State or give money to the Islamic State. They'll say, aren't these brave and noble warriors doing good?
Right.
Right? And
so it's encouragement.
It's encouragement.
But it's indirect.
Admiration.
Right.
Right? But this is where C-51 comes in.
No, actually, C-51 doesn't go this far.
Really?
Yeah, we'll come back to that in a second. Okay. So in the UK, this would be known as a glorification offense.
Yeah.
In the French context, it would be apologie. And so in many European jurisdictions, so United Kingdom, France, Spain, some other continental jurisdictions, this sort of glorification is in fact an offense. So take the United Kingdom example. In 2006, it introduced a new offense called encouragement of terrorism, and the crime reaches indirect encouragement that glorifies the commission or preparation of terrorism crimes, whether in the past, future, or generally, so long as members of the public could reasonably infer that the glorified behavior was conduct that was to be emulated in the existing circumstances.
So we don't have this law.
We don't have this stuff.
And would this survive our charter?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so, right? All right. So we haven't enacted it, but so remember, free speech does not reach violence. Okay, so how proximate is this indirect encouragement to violence? We're now talking about several degrees of distance.
Yeah, because you're now saying I approve of this, not you should.
Right. So waving the Tamil Tiger flag at a protest, because it's not just speech we're talking about; it's different forms of expression. All of this is captured. Is that criminalized in Canada? No. Would it be criminalized as indirect encouragement under a glorification offense potentially? And so this has actually been a debate for at least a decade in Canada.
Yeah, I know, because this is honestly, this is one of the hardest things. If you have radicalizers in community, they're smart. right? I don't think they've sat down and read the criminal code, but they know where those lines are. And this is the kind of things that they're going to say.
Right.
So, right.
And they do in the UK, even in the UK where you have this offense, they will skate very close to the edge of it. The bottom line, so there are a couple of issues around glorification offenses. The first is the constitutional issue, right? And so I don't think there's much doubt that it would violate Section 2. The only issue is whether...
Section 2, because that's the free speech.
Free speech protection.
Right.
Because it's far removed from violence. And so it's not going to be excluded from free expression because of that limitation that's part of Section 2. It says it doesn't reach threats or acts of violence. It would have to be upheld under Section 1 in the same way that hate crime was upheld
right.
under Section 1. And I'm not persuaded it could be, right? Because there has to be a justification, and the justification requires a lot of evidence about the implications of this offense. And I'm not going to get into that. Kent Roach and I wrote a big, long article about glorification offense. Yeah, all 60 pages of it. And we had real doubts as to whether...
It's long.
Got lots of footnotes, so you don't have to read those. We had real doubts as to whether Section 1 could uphold such an offense. And there are a couple of policy reasons to doubt it, right? So if you take speech, people who speak, and you put them in jail... does that actually stave off security perils or not? So if you take people who speak, first of all, you're going to take that speech and you're going to convert it into this martyr speech. You put them in jail. Are they going to come out any better than they were before you put them into jail? Well, this is part of the issue about putting radicalizers in jail. Now you've got a hothouse. Are you better off?
Which is the situation in France.
Which is the situation in France and in the United Kingdom as well, where they're really struggling with this. So there are reasons to doubt that the big hammer of the criminal law is an effective tool to stamp down on ideas. That it's neither a deterrent nor does it necessarily stave off the peril that you hope to deter. So the bottom line is that you can have a real serious debate about whether this is useful or not. There was some early enthusiasm for this idea back in 2006 when the original Anti-Terrorism Act, Bill C-36, was up for its five-year review, and the Commons Committee looked at glorification offenses and said, this is a terrific idea, let's have one. It never went anywhere until...
dun, 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 C-51?
C-51, right. Now, C-51 didn't go all the way to a glorification offense, so it would not reach, hooray, our brave fighters in the Upper Slobovia Assembly of Patriots, but what would it reach?
Every person who, by communicating statements, knowingly advocates or promotes the commission of terrorism offenses in general, other than an offense under the section, while knowing that any of those offenses will be committed or being reckless as to whether any of those offenses may be committed as a result of such communication, is guilty of an indictable offense and is likely to imprisonment for a term of not more than 5 years.
Right.
So in other words, you basically, if you communicate the statement, whether you know or you don't know, if someone else is going to be inspired to do something, you can be potentially held responsible.
Well, you have to know about, you have to be reckless as to the likelihood at the very least.
Right.
Okay. Now, how much of a check is that? So you go up in front of a big crowd or on social media, you're pretty reckless if you say something that's quite extreme without being aware that there's someone on that social media or in that crowd who might be inspired. So that's not much of a constraint on this offense. So really the focus has been on that front end. Every person who communicates statements knowingly advocating or promoting the commission of a terrorism offense in general. So there are a couple of aspects about that. Well, first of all, it would not reach, hooray, our brave fighters, right? So knowingly advocating or promoting the commission of terrorism offenses in general is different from indirect encouragement.
Right,
so
or approval, or just saying, hey,
exactly.
This is awesome.
So it's not as sweeping as a glorification offense.
Right.
It is arguably more sweeping than counseling, and arguably more sweeping than instruction. And the reason that I say arguably is because we don't know what terrorism offenses in general means.
Right.
This is the problem. So terrorism offenses is a defined term in the criminal code. It's basically a list of terrorism offenses.
Which you can find in Section 8301.
Right, and a couple of other places,
yeah.
Right? So you can find the definition of terrorism offenses. I think it's in Section 2 of the code.
But terrorism offenses
in
general,
we don't really know what that means.
Right.
Okay, and so there's
you know, terrorism-ish.
Yeah, right. So there's uncertainty there.
Right.
The other issue here is this reference to knowingly.
Right.
So this offense, the closest analog is actually that willful promotion of hate crime that we talked about at the beginning of this podcast, which talks about willfully advocating or promoting hatred. There's a difference between knowingly and willfully. This is one of these sort of inside baseball legal issues.
Yeah. What is
so
the difference?
So knowingly, I can know something without approving of it.
Right.
So I can know when I say something, and I sometimes read out Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, the passage where he endorses violence as part of anti-colonial struggle.
Right.
I can know that in doing so, I'm advocating and promoting terrorism offenses without wishing that those terrorism offenses occur, right? And so the term willful builds in for the purpose of. And in fact, that's the way it was interpreted in the Keekstra case by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said that the hate crime provisions survive constitutional challenge because willful imputed the intent that this bad thing happened to the speaker. Willful was the magic word.
So if I read in class for the purposes of teaching, one of Bin Laden's letters to America, where he's basically, we're going to kill you all and you deserve it, that kind of thing. That is knowingly doing something, but not for the purpose of,
right.
Which would be willingly.
So arguably you're captured by the offense. And if you're reckless as to who's in your classroom.
I might have to go change my syllabus right now.
Well, so the reality is if this were ever prosecuted, almost certainly the court would read it narrowly.
Right.
But the bottom line is there's no defenses. Unlike for the willful promotion of hate, which had those offenses we enumerated, Parliament, when it enacted this in C-51, did not include any of the defenses.
Oh, boy.
So when Kent Roach and I, when we raised concerns about this offense, we really had two problems. The first problem is what gap is really being filled here that isn't captured by all the other scenarios we had up to speaker number 7.
Right.
So what is it that you're really trying to target? Because as we've said, someone like John McGuire, who was much in the news at that time, he's an offender several times over. You can prosecute him under several different provisions in the criminal code. We didn't really get a clear answer from the government. The government did say, Justice Minister McKay at the time, they argued that the crime was necessary because existing offenses will not capture active encouragement that unspecified action should be taken to do something bad against Canadians or our allies or to do something to support extreme jihadism.
Okay, so you're basically saying it doesn't reach the kind of thing that we are. John McGuire's already covered.
John McGuire's covered.
And this doesn't reach the point of saying, I like Al-Qaeda.
It's not an encouragement offense.
Right.
So what is it covering? And for a long time, I didn't get a good answer, and I still haven't actually got a good government answer on this. I do have another hypothetical here we'll get to in a second, a not-so-hypothetical hypothetical, which may be the gap that's being filled. But the bottom line is it was never clear what gap was being filled. First objection. Second objection, really, did you have to draft it this way? Did you have to draft it with such uncertainty that you would have to sit down and have a big
terrorism
debate?
Terrorism offenses in general versus terrorism knowing offenses versus in general, willingly. Right? Yeah.
So I sat down with a number of defense lawyers and over a span of about an hour, and we debated, for example, whether the Tory fundraising letter that reproduced Al-Shabaab propaganda, whether that violated this provision in the criminal code. And there was not a consensus on that. And that was about, if you were billing for that, that would have been about $6,000-$7,000 of legal time. Right. So to have an offense that's this ambiguous is really, really unhelpful, which is one reason why, frankly, prosecutors would be nuts to proceed with the prosecution, because it's instantaneously going to be a constitutional challenge. Mm-hmm. More than that, you only get 5 years. So why would you go after John McGuire using this when if you go after him for a participation offense, I believe the maximum penalty there is 14 years. So it's not a tremendously useful offense for some of the more notorious cases that were in the public eye at the time. So that's the first issue. Terrorism offenses in general, don't know what that means. And then using knowingly rather than willfully. And so Kent and I said, just put in the word willfully, right? And then, you know, many of the constitutional objections, because then you're imputing a purpose. You're doing it for the purpose of promoting and advocating terrorism offenses, right? So not just knowing that you're doing it, but for the purpose of.
Right.
So for whatever reason, Parliament decided that this was language that could never be modified and under the last government and refused to do so.
So this is where we are with C-51.
That's C-51.
This is where we are right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what does C-59 do?
Right.
Well, what C-59 does is it rolls back the promotion and advocacy.
It eliminates this.
It all it does, it doesn't eliminate the offense. It preserves the offense, but it makes it what I consider a fairly conventional counseling offense.
Right.
So it narrows it.
Right.
And it mirrors
the language elsewhere in the criminal code.
Right. It uses a concept of counseling, which is well understood in criminal law. And it talks about now every person who counsels another person to commit a terrorism offense without identifying a specific terrorism offense is guilty of an indictable offense and can go to jail for 5 years. Now, the difference between that and counseling, the government takes the view that counseling requires a specificity. You have to, you know, specifically identify the offense in order to be charged with conventional counseling. I'm not sure about that, and I've been talking to, I'm not a specialist on this in criminal law, but I've been talking to people who work in this area, and they're not sure.
You're probably doing better than me, to be fair.
So they're not sure that this is really, this idea of specificity really matters, and that conventional counseling probably doesn't require that degree of specificity. So arguably what's happening with the C-59 changes, it's redundant with what's already in the criminal code.
Right.
And so that's one of these
issues.
But
there's an optic issue. You don't want to be seen as taking it out of the criminal code, even if it's already there.
Right.
I think that's more of a political decision.
It is. And so the debate, the partisan debate or the debate in Parliament will be, is this redundant and do we need that broad provision that existed in C-51.
But is it, the question is it weakening it?
Well, it depends what you mean by
weakening.
Because
I think that's where you're going to get the criticism, because you're saying, you know, I've already seen some complaints on Twitter that the C-59 is actually weakening the C-51 provisions, particularly on terrorism speech crime.
Well, I mean, you got to look at C-59 as a bundle, as we will do for the next few podcasts. And overall, if one were to mark up on two columns, powers that increase the capacity of the state to engage in national security, data collection, data sharing, active measures in terms of cyber, et cetera, if you to tabulate the increased powers versus the changes that are made to C-51, which I think have the effect of making the C-51 powers usable, then I think a net C-59 is expansive of state power. Not reductive of state power.
Oh yeah, I agree with that. I just like
on this one, I don't think the C-51 speech crime is usable because of that uncertainty.
Right.
And instantaneously, you'd have a constitutional challenge. It may get thrown out. It may not get thrown out. But the bottom line is, it complicates the life for any prosecutor. So at the very least, the C-59 changes make it a usable offense, arguably a one that's redundant with what's already there. Now, the question you might have is there a compromise position between the C-59 changes and what's in C-51? And so Kent and I said in our book, we said, look, at the very least, we don't think it's a useful crime, but at the very least, use willfully rather than knowingly. And so put in for the purpose of provision.
Sure, yeah. Just because it links it to the actual offense, right?
Get rid of terrorism offenses in general, which no one understands,
right?
And talk about terrorist activity, which is a defined term in the criminal code.
Yep.
And then put in the same defenses that are available for willful promotion of hate. And right there, I think you clean up the constitutional issues. Now, I still think that it's probably not that useful an offense, but at the very least, then from my perspective, the
constitutional
complaints.
You're not creating a problem for yourself.
Right, exactly.
Which C-51 arguably does.
So that leaves us with one more hypothetical.
Okay, and this is actually not so much a hypothetical.
No.
This happened. Basically, the Saudi government-linked account, probably, which tweeted out the picture of the Air Canada plane flying towards the CN Tower with the expression, quote, sticking one's nose where it doesn't belong, as the Arabic expression goes, he who interferes with what doesn't concern him finds what doesn't please him. So the subtlety of a threat with 9/11 imagery was...
Right. And this is during the fracas between Saudi Arabia and Canada in August. So this is not a hypothetical. This actually happened.
Yeah.
I wrote a little blog about this, and I said, well, could this, setting aside the jurisdictional issues, which are really complicated, could you ever get these bloggers or tweeters or whatever, setting those aside, substantively, would this violate any provision in the criminal code? And frankly, the only one that would fit is 83.221, advocating and promoting terrorism offenses in general. And arguably, it's exactly what would fall. It is the thing that would fall in the gap, because I don't think anything, it's not counseling, it's not instruction. So it would only be reached by this speech crime that was created by C-51. Now,
and what would happen with C-59?
Well, C-59, because it talks about counseling, because I don't think this is counseling, this would not be a criminal act.
Okay.
Right. So this is the closest thing I have found that falls in a gap. Now, we can have an argument about whether we think that someone who tweets this should go to jail.
Or could even reasonably put them in jail because they're probably in Riyadh.
Yeah, well, setting aside the jurisdictional issues and extradition, let's assume you could put your hands on this person and the criminal code reached their conduct in terms of its reach territorially, would it be a good idea to put the person who tweeted this image with the statement in jail? From a policy perspective.
Wow, yeah.
So you take someone who probably not a hardcore propagandist, you put them in jail for upwards of 5 years. Do they come out sympathetic to the society in which they find themselves? Or are you simply creating a greater peril than you purport to stave off? Right? Because we're talking about speech that's right on the cusp of something that is really protected by free speech. And like I said, the only way you could preserve this speech crime right now is a Section 1 justification.
I mean, I think to me, like, say this was a Canadian who had made this particular tweet, not a Saudi person in Riyadh. To me, this illustrates the importance of having a variety of tools to deal with violent extremists, right? Because clearly this is something maybe you want to address. Maybe could this be the subject of a peace bond?
But this is our segue, because there's two issues here. Do you want to prosecute this person? I say no. Do you want their tweet still to be up? So this is the terrorism propaganda issue. Can you do something about the tweet? And the answer is yes. So in fact, in C-51, not only did they create the speech crime, but they also created a system where you could tear down through a court process from computer networks. You could tear down what's called terrorism propaganda, the definition of which maps the same language from the speech crime. Promotion and advocacy of terrorism offenses in general.
But if this doesn't meet part one of C-59... can't meet part two.
Well, that's it. So C-59 is going to preserve the idea of terrorism propaganda, but it's going to remove the language advocating and promoting terrorism offenses in general and use that counseling language that we talked about a moment ago.
So you couldn't take this down then?
Probably it's not counseling. So for me, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of teardown orders, right? And we can talk about how well those are going to work. And there is one, right? We're talking about this today in part because Colin Fries in the Globe and Mail at the beginning of the week, for the first time ever, the government has sought a teardown order. It's now proceeding in court in Montreal. It's under seal. We don't know what it is. We don't know what it, you can see if the government's perspective. We're trying to tear down something that's terrorist propaganda. We don't really want to advertise the terrorism propaganda.
Exactly, but it shows you the problem with these laws, right? Like,
But bottom line is, look, should you have a teardown provision? And I think I can see the argument why you would want a teardown provision. You don't have to be in lockstep, though, with the provisions that put people in jail. You could have teardown provisions that are broader than the provisions that put people in jail. So actually, what Kent and I said, we said, look, we don't really like the teardown provisions because we're civil libertarian enough, not really like the idea of constraints on speech. But we'll accept that just as we've got teardown orders for hate speech, which, by the way, have never been used, as best I know.
Really?
They've been there since 2001.
Are you sure?
There was one under the Canada Human Rights Act that was used to tear down stuff, but the criminal code one has never been used as best I know.
For terrorism?
No, for hate speech.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So just as we have that provision on the books, so too we think it's plausible to have a provision that allows you to tear down terrorist speech. We said the speech that should be teared down was counseling or instruction, that broad offense that we talked about moments ago. The government in C-59 has opted just for counseling. So there is some wiggle room in terms of the speech issue. The C-51 went too far, in my view. C-59 clamps down. There is a middle part that you could have an intelligent discussion about, and you could structure this to minimize constitutional issues. C-51 didn't.
Can I just say, wouldn't the middle ground here be like maybe just get the social media company to enforces probably what's its own terms of service?
For practical purposes, absolutely.
That's the
because
way I
you
would
don't
do
have
it.
To have a court proceeding. And you phone them up and say, you realize this is on your platform. Isn't this a bad thing? And that's in practice what happens. But there may be circumstances, and they would be very idiosyncratic circumstances. And I don't know what's at issue in Montreal. It'll be really peculiar because it has to be a posting that's within the jurisdiction of the Canadian court. So it's not some foreign posting. It's within the jurisdiction of the Canadian court that is important enough that the government's going through this arduous judicial process, which incidentally is not going to necessarily involve another party because...
Or even necessarily exist in a few years or in a year or two.
Well, yes. And so one of the questions we have is, could the government have... We don't know what the content of what they're trying to tear down is. So that's the problem. We don't know if C-59 will change it so that it couldn't have been used for that same speech because we don't know what the speech is. The speech could actually be counseling. It could actually be counseling speech that they're trying to tear down. And so the C-59 will have no impact whatsoever. But if it's something above and beyond counseling that's outside that orbit, then yes, once C-59 goes through, that power will be unavailable. So we don't know enough details to make an opinion one way or another.
But it probably isn't counseling to piracy.
Probably not.
Right.
Okay.
Just bringing that all together.
So I think that's the time we have for today. This is kind of a dense issue.
It was a good way to structure it. And it shows, I think this is what we want to do with the podcast maybe for the next couple of weeks. This is I think having the choose your own adventure style is good. So what would this look like before? What does this look like under C-51? What will this now look like under C-59? And you do all the legwork too. So that's helpful.
All right. That's the time we have for today. Thanks everyone. And we hope to be back next week.
See you then.